now carry out a literal execution, and nobody gets in trouble for it. So I think that we have to keep in mind that, especially, you know, as we look to, quote, you know, rebuild the Gulf Coast after these disasters, that more and more, you know, we're going to be seeing a federal role. And you already see movement to do away with all portions of the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act. And the Posse Comitatus Act severely restricted what the U.S. Army or the U.S. Armed Forces could do, any kind of what we would call law enforcement role that they would have in this country. We were very, very strict about how we, you know, applied that. As again, they did not want the idea of an occupying army and an occupy, you know, and what they saw in Europe. And they did not want, you know, that kind of a situation to be prevalent in the United States. But you're going to see more and more pressure to do away with that, because with armed forces, what you have in essence is a large reserve army of the unemployed or the underemployed. And, you know, all of a sudden, hey, we've got a lot of manpower we can take to one place or another. And no doubt in the, you know, I'm sure that a lot of people in New Orleans were probably relieved to see National Guardsmen, which theoretically still have state ties, but, you know, on the streets. But after a while, they probably would get very, very tired of their presence, because you come to understand that, in essence, they see themselves as occupying a city. And that would be the, you know, the case when you have a large federal role in disaster relief. And the problem is, most Americans really do not think in terms of liberty or what would
it takes all sorts of twists. A word of caution here, because we deal with a lot of heavy issues. We've always tried to either look back in perspective with a mind toward the future, or take what various people are saying and project toward the future what will most likely come about. This is not a prophetic role. This is simply more of an intelligence role. But the other half is, remember, you have a life to live. I used to talk to some survivalists, and they go, oh, we're, you know, doing this, and we're going to survive here, and we're going to stay up there, and we're going to blah, 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 and we're going to survive. And I asked them a question. I said, what are you surviving for? And they didn't have an answer. Their whole purpose in life was surviving. But because they were so busy surviving, they weren't living. So these things have a way of going their way. God has a purpose for your life. Find out what that purpose is and fulfill it. That's pretty much all you have to do. By the way, if you do that, you'll be quite busy. I assure you. And the purpose keeps changing, because God has a way of only letting you know what's happening on an as-needs basis as you go. You don't get to see the end from the beginning in your life except knowing where you go. At least that's Christian belief, that if we know we are saved in Christ, we know what our eternal destination is. So that's the whole bottom part on that. All right, back to my guest right now, back to political topics. William Anderson, Professor William Anderson at Frostburg State University. His article on the Von Mises website, it's actually Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S.org, the Austrian School of Economics. The article is entitled Katrina and the Never-Ending Scandal of State Management. And what we were talking about just as we went into the break, Bill, is the fact that we have seen over the last few presidents, doesn't make any difference whether they were Republicans or Democrats, a consistent growing expansive role of government.
I was reading James Bovard's book about the Clinton administration called Feeling Your Pain, and he said that, he published it in 2000, he said, since taking office in January 1993, President Clinton has declared a major disaster someplace in the nation on average every week. And, you know, once you start expanding the role of FEMA, then, of course, you're going to deal with turf issues. And, for example, even a lot of the local
Have you got him yet?
Tell me when we got him.
Martin.
What?
Tell me when we got
him. Kevin's calling him.
I wish you'd get him ahead, because he needs to hear my intro. Otherwise, he doesn't know what I'm talking about. Come on, Kevin, get him on top.
I got booted from there.
The views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, welcome to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. I'm Michael Shaw, your host tonight, and tonight we're going to talk about how to separate the state from school, from charity, and from business. In other words, how to create a moral society. Our special guest tonight, Jacob Hornberger, is not your regular libertarian. He's not a third-way privatizer. He doesn't support managed global trade or anarcho-capitalism. Instead, he espouses consistent principles of liberty regarding parenthood, private property, and the establishment of a moral and legitimate government. We're going to hear also tonight about America's rapidly growing government and how it is threatening the core of our civil liberties. Jacob Hornberger is the founder and president of the Future of Freedom Foundation, located in Virginia. Mr. Hornberger is an attorney. He's been an adjunct professor at the University of Dallas, where he taught law and economics. In 1989, Mr. Hornberger founded the Future of Freedom Foundation. He's a regular writer for the foundation's publication, Freedom Daily. He has debated ideas on free market principles with groups all over the United States and really all over the world. His editorials have appeared in the Washington Post and the Charlotte Observer and other newspapers in the United States and in Latin America. So he's been the contributor to 8 books that have been published by the foundation, and I'm going to welcome to our audience Jacob Hornberger. Jacob, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on our show tonight, and I know I have read a number of the Freedom Daily articles that you've written and that others have written. And it always provides an evening of satisfaction and inspiration when I do that, because the notions that are expanded upon in that publication are truly satisfying and inspiring.
Oh, thank you. It's very nice to hear that and get that kind of feedback.
Well, let's start right in and talk about some of the issues that you have been dealing with. And one of our favorite subjects at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz and on our radio show was the state of education in America, and what is it that ails our education system, and what the average parent can do to begin to salvage that situation.
Well, the problem is that we have become so accustomed in American life to having government run certain enterprises that it is very difficult for people to imagine what a free market would look like. We're not the first ones to face this quandary. The Russian people faced this with, for example, the production of shoes. If you told the Russians that, look, if you just free up the market and get the state out of the production of foods operations or shoes operations, everything will work out fine. They would look at you very skeptically and say, well, how would that work? That's impossible. How would
the market produce the right number of shoes and the correct colors and the right sizes, that you need a government commission to coordinate all this. Well, Americans would look at that and say, well, that's an easy one to solve, until all of a sudden we start talking about education. And then Americans take the same position. Oh my gosh, you know, how would the poor get educated? How would we know how many schools were enough? And so forth.
We'll be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station with our special guest, Jacob Hornberg.
You might be wondering if Freedom 21 Santa Cruz is a liberal or a conservative organization. Are they left or right, Republican or Democrat? But you'll find that none of these one-dimensional labels applies to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, nor to many of its participants. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz dialogue doesn't take place in a left-right, liberal-conservative dialectic, but on a spectrum between liberty and tyranny. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz participants include people from all political parties, religions, races, and backgrounds who are united in the pursuit of individual liberty and the protection of our U.S. Constitutional Republic. To find out how you can donate to or participate in Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232.
Well, welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station. While some of our stations take a continued commercial break, we're going to get back to our discussion with Jacob Hornberger. Your comparison between Russian schools and Russian shoes and American schools is an interesting one, Jacob. Let's continue with that concept.
Well, so you have this problem of, you know, what do we do about the educational system? I mean, everyone knows it doesn't work. Even the government administrators admit that it hasn't worked. Otherwise, they wouldn't be coming up with all of these new reform plans constantly. You know, every 5 years, there's a new five-year plan. And now, of course, it's even gotten to the point where local school districts are thriving, practically begging for federal government intervention. Well, I think we finally have to reach a realization that this will never work, that this is what's called central planning. This is why it didn't work in the Soviet Union. This is government planning of essentially a peaceful, creative activity. And we know that socialism doesn't work. We've seen it in practice. We know intellectually it can't work. You've got this government administrators, government commissions, politicians, and bureaucrats trying to plan this activity much as an army-type structure. The only solution, Mike, ultimately is the free market. The free market produces the best of everything. We know that as Americans. It produces the best automobiles, the best computers, the best churches, the best books, the best of everything, and government produces the worst of everything. And so what we challenge people with at the Future of Freedom Foundation in the realm of education, and we've published a great book in this area called Separating School and State by Sheldon Richman, is why not turn education over to the free market? Why not
hold that thought for just a second, Jacob. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station with our guest, Jacob Hornberger, who is describing why it is that centralized school policies inevitably fail, just as centralized production of shoes would fail if we were to endeavor that activity. Jacob, it's the planned activity concept that you talk about, and the five-year reform plans, and the fact that local schools are begging for federal funds and federal assistance, really all does begin to size up our educational system as a five-year Chinese cultural plan, or as the Russians would do, always renewing their failed programs with new verbiage and the same failure. But here in America, it seems to me that the educational system really is in decline, and the students who come out, there's almost two classes of students. The class that really gains no information for a valid and useful life, and the class of students who are, it seems to me, and certainly here in Santa Cruz, you find with Model UN programs and the like, a class of students who are chosen because they do have some skills And these kids are particularly indoctrinated with values that are not reflective of the American experience. In essence, they're being recruited into a new order of things. I always like to call them the slave masters and the worker bees seem to be the categories of students that are coming out of our schools here on the West Coast anyway.
I think your analogy to a beehive is perfect. That's what essentially the whole structure is based on, is the whole mission of public government schools is to produce the good citizen, the good little citizen who will do what he's told, don't question authority, blindly support whatever federal officials do, and pay your taxes, and keep your head down, don't ask too many questions, especially with respect to what the government does in foreign affairs. And so when you get a nonconformist in public schools, the whole machinery goes into operation. They'll either drug him with something like Ritalin, because they'll say something's wrong with that kid, and it never enters their mind that there's nothing wrong with the kid. What's wrong is with the system, and the kid is starting to instinctively realize that and recoil against it. Well, as he recoils, the machinery starts to grind him into submission, into conformity. Imagine a Henry David Thoreau, for example, being sent into public schools. And this is what they're doing. They're destroying the individuality, Michael, the love of learning. The what's the most common word a five-year-old asks before he's entered into this system? And he badgers his parents with why, because he's got this wonder of the universe. That, by the time he's 18, is gone. He hates school, he hates learning, he hates books. And those who thrive do so despite the system, not because of it.
Well, that's right. To me, it starts with the attitude that's expressed very cleanly and clearly by the principal of a new high school in this county who's published as having said, quote, "The students need to become global citizens," said the principal of the school. And in his words means they need to learn to take care of the land around them. So with that attitude, number one, we are instilling non-individual values, and number two, we're making this little beehive of workers, little biological resources who are being prepared by government schools for their assignment given to them by government.
That is exactly right. They are, you said it perfectly, they are the worker bees. That you here are to serve the collective. You are not to serve yourself, that you don't live for yourself, for your own pursuit of happiness, that you are here working out your assigned role, and when we call on you through a draft or through national compulsory service or some other vehicle like that, you will respond positively, because that's what a good citizen does. It's no different from what the Russian people were taught throughout the era of socialist central planning.
Well, I know I've seen some of your writings refer to the Sovietization of America, and it's certainly a regular theme of mine and others here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, that America really has adopted a Soviet system of government increasingly as systems of councils begin to appear everywhere, unelected councils that are making the rules and requirements that we have to live by, and that to be on these councils you've got to be a person of groupthink, and the result of it is a socialized economy, and of course today we call it public-private partnerships. Our society is sinking quickly. I'm very optimistic that's going to turn around, because it's becoming quite apparent, and more people are suffering as a result of this de-evolution of the American experience. But it's got to start in schools, and until a shift in our school attitudes change, we're not going to begin the process of reversal, and that will take probably a period of 12 years. You take a first grader, you got to get him through high school and in a free world before he's able to launch out onto his own and become a contributor to a society that is committed to the ideals of well, the American founding and the ideals of the importance of supreme importance of each human being. And of course, today we're just on an opposite path.
We are, and it is a difficult path. In some ways, the path that the Americans are following is much more difficult than the one the Russians were following. But by the same token, in a way, it's easier too. And what I mean by that is it's more difficult because Russians at least understood the type of system that they were living under. I mean, they knew this is socialism. Americans honestly believe this is freedom. I mean, they believe public schooling, despite the fact it is a government structure with mandatory laws. If you don't send your kids into this system, you will go to jail. Americans think this is freedom. They think Social Security, which originated among German socialists, is freedom. They think Medicare and Medicaid. And so we have the problem of what the German thinker Goethe referred to as those who falsely believe they are free are the ones who are the ones most enslaved. Well, but if, as Americans discover what's happened and how Americans in the 20th century rejected the philosophy on which this country was founded, which itself rejected things like Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security and income taxation under the concept of genuine freedom.
And government schooling.
And government schooling. Then as you discover the truth to that, then all of a sudden people discover the heritage of what this country was once all about, that rejected all those things. And that's what gives me hope, is that once people realize they've been lied to, sometimes the reaction is much more fervent than somebody who just grows up knowing that they're living under a socialist system.
Well, I think that's right. It gives me the great hope also. There's a great writing that we're about to post on our website at Freedom 21 that compares Russian propaganda with American propaganda. And there have been many Russians who've come to the United States and said the difference between the propaganda systems is that in Russia, we knew the Pravda was propaganda. But here in the United States, most Americans don't know that the AP is propaganda.
Well, that's the problem, is that they've been taught that this is all just sort of part of free enterprise. It's all just part of free enterprise. So they don't challenge, they don't question. But what's interesting is that the more the government moves into people's lives and botches up people's lives, I mean, I don't know of very many things that the federal government has handled for the last 50 years that aren't a total mess.
Oh, but they're going to rebuild New Orleans and just make a marvelous, sustainable city out of New Orleans with their hundreds of billions of dollars. Won't that be a marvelous achievement?
Yeah, that's a classic example of the people running to the daddy, to the federal daddy who has abused them time and time again, totally incompetent, and they're saying, oh, central planners are going to rebuild the city. Instead of saying, just let the market operate. Let private entrepreneurs develop this naturally. You've got all this corrupt money that's going down there. I don't know if you're keeping track of it, but, man, there are so many no-bid contracts. I mean, this is the biggest bonanza for the politically connected has ever existed, I think.
Well, you know, it's if you look into the smart growth websites and into the sustainable development websites generally, they're all excited about the money, the private public partnership money coming into New Orleans. I can tell you that here in Santa Cruz, we've been receiving those kinds of monies, not in that volume, but $300 million have been granted by state and federal government into the building of the first 4,000 government-controlled housing units along the Central California coastline to be controlled by our local planning department with a housing authority to choose who lives there and to choose who builds the units and to choose all the terms of living there, how much water you can use, how much electricity you can use, etc. You know, the prototype sustainable plan, and it's just rife with corruption from the determination of who receives the money to the determination of who lives there to the determination of all aspects of it. And this really is the model that will be utilized in New Orleans, and it's a sorry case because over some period of time, even with the manipulation of the Bank of International Settlements, who can take U.S. dollars and European euros and Japanese yen and combine them all together and play their magic and extend the life of them all a bit longer than might otherwise be the case, at some point this globalist monetary system and this globalist plan for how to run all societies just falls from its own weight, and that's going to be a heavy price for Americans and the rest of humanity to bear.
We may be facing a perfect government storm. There's no question about it.
Well, and you know, the great opportunity here is the prospect for an American awakening that begins to understand that we're our own solution to the problems we have, and that by working in the American tradition, we're going to create a better society. We'll be right back at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station. While some of our stations, affiliate stations, take a commercial break with our special guest, Jacob Hornberger of the Future of Freedom Foundation. And Jacob, let's talk a bit about charities and the role of government in playing the charitable role. I mean, it ties right back into the New Orleans dynamic, but we've certainly seen increasingly, and with the current president's focus on faith-based initiatives like his No Child Left Behind initiatives, all coming from the central government that's going to solve our education problems and create some charitable abyss through government intervention. What are your notions about the government and charity?
Well, it's right along. It's a variation of what you were talking about in terms of government-business partnerships in the economic or business arena. This is a government-business partnership to help the poor and the needy and the ones that have been harmed or damaged by the hurricane. Essentially, it's the whole concept of the socialistic welfare state. I mean, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. And the president behaves as if the private relief efforts are exactly the same in nature as the government relief agency. And in fact, he says, oh, we're rich, there's no problem, we have enough money. I mean, so he's just writing checks, he's giving out credit cards. What we have to come to understand is that this is money that is coercively taken from the American people. It is diametrically opposite to how the Red Cross raises its money. The Red Cross has to persuade people to write out a check and send it to them. Same thing with Catholic Charities or March of Dimes or any of these other United Way. The government works exact opposite. They use the IRS to force people to take their money and then redistribute it out at your welfare agencies. What we do at the Future of Freedom Foundation is we first talk about the immorality of that action, that nobody's a good person through that process. The president isn't a better person. It's not his money. He's not writing his own check. He's writing a check drawn on the money that's been taken by the IRS. You're not a better person. You're not a better Christian because the president is out here spending tax money on your behalf. The bureaucrat's not a better person. It's a corrupting process. It's an immoral process. And it's exactly opposite to the process that our ancestors believed in. Our ancestors said, no taxation on income. You keep everything you earn, you decide what to do with it, but government's not going to be here to take care of you. And so Americans were self-reliant, they were hardy, they were individualists. They faced crises, they faced hurricanes, they faced earthquakes, but they didn't run to the federal daddy or to the government daddy to help them out. And that's what made this country the strongest country in the world, was not the government. The government was weak, it was the people that were so strong. We've got the exact opposite now. We got the strongest government in history. But look at their New Orleans case. Everybody's waiting for the federal daddy to come and bail them out, from the Louisiana governor all the way on down.
Well, and even many of the Louisiana residents. You know, the flood, the Mississippi flood of 1927, or the San Francisco earthquake of 1906, the response was much quicker to the relief that was necessary because people were the self-reliance that rises when dependency isn't encouraged is a much more effective tool at dealing with any sort of emergency. And like you say, the concept. Excuse us. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station with our special guest, Jacob Hornberger, and we're talking now. We have been talking through this last break about the consequences of government interference in charitable activity and how in a moral society coercion isn't the basis of benevolence, but self-help and mutual aid it really is. And how it is that in the past we were much more responsive with more limited means perhaps, but more responsive to emergency circumstances that would arise from time to time when people worked together on a local basis. Of course, today we can help out with money from long distance on a rather immediate basis. But when people aren't reliant upon their dependency on government, that society just works so much better.
Mike, you know, a good example of this whole thing is Medicare and Medicaid. I mean, we've been arguing for 15 years at the Future of Freedom Foundation is it just junk these things, get rid of them, repeal them, don't reform them. They're the reason for the skyrocketing health care costs. And one of the responses we get is, oh, well, doctors wouldn't take care of the poor. I mean, you have to force them. You have to pay for them from government assistance and so forth. You have to have these socialist plans. And I've argued this is nonsense, that doctors will take care of people when people are really in need. You can count on that. You just got to believe in yourself. You got to believe in freedom, and you got to believe in other people. Well, look at this Hurricane Katrina disaster. The medical profession has responded immediately. I mean, doctors providing free health care for people in need, flying into New Orleans from all over the country, fighting to get in there to help. This is what true charity is all about. And you can count on a certain sector in society to always do that. What the government does is it destroys that belief in ourselves and that belief in the free market. If we can restore that self-esteem and that belief in ourselves and in freedom, then you're going to start seeing the dismantling of these government programs.
Well, and if we don't do that, we're going to see ourselves falling deeper and deeper into the Soviet system hole, where nobody does anything and everything just gets worse by the decade.
Well, and the monetary system, I mean, they're spending money like it was going out of style, but ultimately this is going to be reflected in a debased currency. I mean, remember, conservatives used to brag that this is how they brought down the Soviet Union, by making the Soviet government spend the nation into bankruptcy. That's exactly what the U.S. government is now doing to our nation. It is spending our nation into bankruptcy.
Under the so-called leadership of conservatives, I might add.
Of course. Whose spending habits are much worse than the Democrats.
Yes.
And they're bad enough.
Well, you know, one of the things that we've talked about a little bit on this radio show in the context of the Republican Party is their affiliation with the International Democrat Union. That's IDU.org. You can find it on the web. And at the IDU.org, you've got 80 political parties from around the country all committed to the implementation of the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, which is the antithesis philosophically of the United States Declaration of Independence. And lo and behold, who are members but the Republican Party of the United States? And Haley Barbour is the regional, the Americans, not the American, but the Americas, the continent's representative on the IDU. And what we've got is just a total default by the Republican Party of the principles that most Republicans rank and file believe in, the notion of independence and individualism and liberty and mutual benefit and mutual aid and free markets, etc. So we really are being beguiled by our political leaders who are Democrat, Republican, leading us down the path toward financial debasement and individual loss of individuality.
There's no question about it. And until the American people finally wake up and realize the danger, they're going to continue going down this path. I mean, you are absolutely correct in pointing out the fallacies of these UN rights. And this is where lack of understanding, and this is the type of garbage they teach in these public schools, these rights that are in the UN, like the right to health care and the right to education and the right to a job, you know, all these rights that essentially enable you to use the state to get into somebody else's pocketbook and take away his money and his freedom. And then so when these rights are engrafted in the Iraq Constitution, for example, you know, the government says, oh, this is freedom, this is freedom. Well, that's not the type of freedom that existed for Americans, say, in 1890, where Americans lived without Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, public schooling, income taxation, a drug war, and all these other so-called rights.
Well, it's a mounting challenge, and I think the American people will be up to it. And we're going to be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station in just a few moments. We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show, and to pick up on that theme, Jacob, you know, I always like to remind people of what the UN Declaration of Human Rights has to say down at the bottom small print in Article 29, Section 3, where they acknowledge that, quote, the rights and freedoms may in no case be exercised contrary to the purposes and principles of the United Nations. In other words, all those freebies that you articulated that are granted by the United Nations can be withdrawn at any time. I mean, this is a system of granted rights and rescinded rights, and whatever the powers that be, and of course we don't even know who the powers are that are behind the United Nations, have the ability to just withdraw whatever rights they choose to withdraw to fit their objectives from time to time, and yet our military goes to war to create a constitution in a country like Iraq that reflects this notion of rights, not the notion of rights that are embedded in the Constitution or for which our forefathers fought for in the Revolutionary War, not the notion that each of us has rights that are inherent to our being. Instead, we're putting our young people in harm's way so that we can create a democracy where rights are to be granted and rescinded at will by the power of men stronger than the average man. And there's something very disturbing about that.
It's extremely disturbing because it's exactly contrary to the philosophy of the Declaration of Independence. I mean, when Jefferson writes that rights are fundamental, that they're inherent, they come from nature and nature's God, what he's saying is that rights pre-exist government. These are fundamental rights. They adhere to the individual because of his nature as an individual. That you don't have to be thankful to the government for your rights, because the government doesn't give you your rights. These rights pre-exist government. Government exists at the behest of people, and they have a right to alter or abolish it whenever government becomes destructive of these rights. That's what Jefferson was saying, and he was taking the wording from John Locke, the English philosopher. In the UN and in all these other constitutions, it's always phrased the exact opposite. They make it sound like your rights are coming from the government, they're privileges. In fact, sometimes they're written of like, you have a right to this, subject to the laws as enacted by the government. Your right to be free to publish books, subject to the rights to the laws enacted by the legislature. Well, that's no right. That's just a privilege, and that's what distinguished this country, is that Americans saw rights as pre-existing and fundamental and inherent, unlike the way they see it now.
Excuse me, Jacob. Sometimes our commercial lens come right up on top of us very fast.
That's all right.
We're here with our special guest, Jacob Hornberger, of the Future of Freedom Foundation, and he's been describing how rights are inherent to the nature of human beings and don't come through grant by government. And, of course, that's what the globalist movement is all about, a system where rights are granted. And, of course, rights that can be granted can be revoked, which means that we all become pawns of a central agency. And here in the United States, forgetting global governance for a minute, we're finding more and more that's the case. You know, you don't put your kid in government schools, or you don't register them, or you don't satisfy the bureaucrat in some way. Well, gee whiz, mom and dad, you can go to jail. And of course, if you happen to build a house on land that you own without permission from your local planning agency, and that may come at a huge price because they clearly don't, at least increasingly here on the West Coast, want people to actually own their own house. They want them to put them in these centralized stack 'em and pack 'em kind of housings along railroad lines. You know, so what we find increasingly is that within our own domestic government, we're finding the rights that we have are being granted to us as privileges, and if you're not a partner of government, you're just not going to be granted those privileges. And so the concept of natural rights, of inherent rights, is fading very quickly from the American scene. But the quicker it passes, the more people wake up, and the more people who wake up, the better the chance is for a renaissance of liberty in this country. Do you think that's occurring?
Yeah. I do. I mean, that's the real irony, is that the more that government crosses the line and pushes its way into the family, you know, Big Brother, or pushes its way into people's pocketbooks or their personal affairs, the more all of a sudden people start reflecting and thinking and asking questions. And I've noticed it. I mean, you know, 10, 15 years ago when I was doing this, I mean, I could light up every phone line on a talk show. Because people just get so upset, at the thought of a free market in education or abolishing Social Security and the audacious idea that the children can honor mother and father on a voluntary basis. Today, I can't do that anymore. I mean, I can tell that while people may not be agreeing with everything we're saying, they're thinking. And I figure as long as somebody's thinking, that's all I want, because I figure we've got the moral high ground on this, not to even mention the economic, pragmatic high ground of higher standards of living and so forth that come from a free society. Another thing, Mike, that we ought to discuss is this concept of democracy, that they preach in these public schools that democracy is freedom, and this is what the whole deal with Iraq. Oh, well, if they've had an election, that means they're free. That's not what this country stood for. Democracy and government itself is actually the greatest threat to freedom. And we had a republic, a limited government, the idea that the Constitution limits the powers of democracy because democracy is doing so dangerous to liberty, and I think we need to emphasize that.
Well, I remember as a young person in parochial school, we were certainly taught that democracy was a very dangerous form of government, and yet I knew even back then that the kids at the government school across town were learning exactly the opposite. They were learning that democracy was the form of American government, and I remember at a very young age that caused me great concern, because once that happens, what James Madison said would be true, that, you know, democracy is the most vile form of government, as short-lived as it is violent in its death. And boy, in 1989, when George Bush Sr. just kept drumming the idea of global democracy, and he followed up with Clinton, and now the current president is talking about democracy as he wages war. It just makes me very saddened, because democracy is not, Plato said democracy leads to dictatorship, and Gorbachev said that the more democracy, the more socialism. So I don't know what more people need to know about democracy than to know that it's a very dangerous form of government.
Well, I was speaking at about three or four classes of public school students. Their teacher, ironically, was a libertarian, and he invited me to speak there. And so the first thing I pointed out to the students, it was like 200 kids in this room, and I said, I'm going to state flat out that the Bill of Rights does not give anyone in this room the right of free speech. And I challenge anyone to disagree with me. I said, how many disagree? Well, everyone raised their hand. And so I said, well, no. And they said, look, we've read it. We know that the Constitution gives you the right of free speech and all this. Fine. No, I said, nope, you're wrong, you're wrong. And finally, a little girl raises her hand, and she says, Mr. Hornberger, I think you're right. The Bill of Rights prohibits the government from taking away our right to free speech. And so that dovetails with what we were talking about earlier, is that the Bill of Rights really doesn't give us rights. It's a bill of prohibitions. It stops democracy. It stops the Congress from taking away our right of free speech and freedom of religion and so forth, because our ancestors feared democracy. They feared the Congress. They feared the federal government. They knew that therein lies the greatest threat to their freedom and their economic well-being. That's why they tied them up with that Constitution and those Bill of Rights.
Well, and that's the importance of the Ninth Amendment, and it's the sadness. The sadness is the fact that students aren't exposed to the Ninth Amendment, and the importance of the notion that our rights are within us, that they are not limited by what's articulated in the quote Bill of Rights. And your expression in that high school class is so important. And it's really a lesson also for our listeners. Get into your high school classes and express to the young people the notion, expose them to the notion that our rights don't come from government, that our rights are natural to our beings as human beings, and that government exists merely for the purpose of protecting our life, our liberty, and our property.
Well put. I mean, and especially in the home. I mean, parents can do a very good job at exposing their children to, an alternative way of thinking. And that's the thinking that guided the framers. We forget how radical Americans really once were. I mean, imagine a society with no public schooling, no Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, drug war, gun control. They didn't even have restrictions on immigration. And no income taxation. I mean, this was a very unusual society. But that's what they celebrated as freedom. When they celebrated the 4th of July in 1895, that's what they were celebrating as freedom. Look at what Americans celebrate today, is the government taking care of them. I mean, that's the concept of freedom that pervades America today. The government is taking care of us. It's our daddy, despite the fact that it does a horrible job of taking care of us, like the fox taking care of the chickens.
Well, they are eating us up as they put more and more people in jail for offenses or for allegations that don't even constitute crimes. I mean, I get saddened by the idea of how our justice system no longer punishes wrongdoers. It punishes people who haven't followed the rules.
Well, there's that great line in Atlas Shrugged, the great novel by Ayn Rand, where this slimy bureaucrat says something like, Mr. Reardon, you think that this is about just breaking the rules? You don't understand. That is our intent, to have so many rules and regulations that businessmen are always in violation of them. That's the way we control them, by hanging this over their head. And I think a good example of this principle is Martha Stewart. I mean, if anybody should not have been in a federal jail, it's that woman. But that you've got these stupid rules and regulations, including lying to a bureaucrat. I mean, she wasn't even under oath. Politicians lie to us every day. We've seen that domestically as well as with Iraq and foreign policies. Nothing happens to them. This woman lies to a bureaucrat and she has to go to jail for it. That's ridiculous.
Well, it's because she's a businessman. And as a business person, I mean, I think any business person out there that's not, quote, a public-private partner would say the risks of being in business today are huge.
Oh, it's enormous. I mean, not only the potential financial loss if you don't jump through all the hoops, the licensures and the permits and starting a new business, but there's criminal violations. If you hire the wrong guy, he's got some dark skin, he happens to be illegal using a fake passport, they can come after you for that, like they went after Walmart.
Well, it's becoming an increasingly risky world to do the things that are natural for human beings to do, that are helpful to others and not harmful to anybody, but they break the power of the government elite, and that's becoming the crime of the day.
That's true. The good part, and I think you've alluded to this, is that ideas have power. I mean, the Chinese government just censored the internet again. They won't let the Chinese people access certain parts of the Internet. Why do they do that? They've got this all-powerful totalitarian government. What are they concerned about? They're concerned about the power of ideas and truth, that if people get a hold of that, they can force a shift even in the power of a totalitarian system. That's where we have it over everyone else in the world. We have ideas, we have truth, and so far the government isn't shutting these down. And that's where I remain so optimistic, especially with the Internet. I mean, the transmission of ideas and talk shows like this, this is where the action is happening in America, Michael.
Well, when David knocked down Goliath, he did it with a finely shaped little stone that was aimed perfectly, and that's what the Internet offers us, is that finely shaped stone that if we put it out there just right, we'll begin to knock down the giant that's trying to take us down. If you've got a question or comment for our guest, Jacob Homburger, our phone number is 888-245-4237. That's 888-24-LIBERTY. Yeah, I know also, Jacob, you've done a lot of work personally, as has the Freedom of Future of Freedom Foundation, on the issue of habeas corpus and Padilla. Is that how you pronounce
it? Padilla.
Padilla?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
The Jose Padilla case is the most ominous threat to our freedom in our lifetime, bar none. I have written more articles on that case than on any other issue in our 15-year history. And what it involves is an American citizen who was arrested on American soil and turned over to military control, turned over to the Pentagon. He's been in a military dungeon in South Carolina for almost 3 years. For most of that time, he was denied any access to an attorney, totally denied due process of law, trial by jury, right to an indictment, right to a speedy trial, all the rights guaranteed by the Bill of Rights, the Fifth, Sixth, and Eighth Amendments, Fourth Amendment, that go all the way back to Magna Carta. And the rationale behind this treatment of this man is that the president has labeled him a terrorist in a document, and that the Pentagon and the president take the position that once they label an American a terrorist, they can completely circumvent and ignore the federal court system and simply punish him under military rule. If they're able to win this case, they will then have the same power that dictators throughout history have had, the power to seize anybody, a critical newspaper editor, a dissident, a protester, and simply sign the document labeling him a terrorist. That would automatically remove him from any federal court interference. His family could not sue. They could not file a petition for writ of habeas corpus, which stretches back through ancient England and its history. That all of those would be suspended if Padilla loses his case. Now, up to this point, up to a month or so ago, Padilla had won the court cases that where they were deciding on this issue. The district court in South Carolina said, not in this country, you're not going to do this, not anytime soon. Well, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond overturned that court and held that the government could do this, that the war on terrorism is like a real war, that the whole world's a battlefield, that Americans are potential enemies in this war, and the military will have this power from here on out. Padilla is expected to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Those of us that have been watching this cannot believe that the Supreme Court would let this stand. It will totally transform the nature of American society. It will essentially give the military a backdoor to rule over Americans, because that power will be hanging over the head of every single American.
Wow. Now, I bet that most of our listeners didn't read that in their local newspaper, whether it was the New York Times or the Los Angeles Times or the San Francisco Examiner or the Santa Cruz Sentinel. That court decision did not get any publicity, did it?
It got very, very little publicity. However, the good news is that 99% of the mainstream press that has written on editorials on the Padilla case and published op-eds are on our side of this issue. They are seeing the danger of this. They see what the enormity of what's happening. And so all somebody has to do is just Google Jose Padilla, or go to our website at fff.org and Google Padilla on our website. And we've got a bunch of articles, both our own article as well as articles we've linked to. And they can see that the big papers, while they haven't addressed it lately, consistently, and the small papers too, are saying this cannot stand in America. This is not what America stands for, terrorism or no terrorism.
Wow. Well, that is a very disheartening case. We're seeing all kinds of high-level courts issuing all kinds of very ominous decisions, whether it has to do with property, the foundation of a free society, or civil liberties, the fruit of a free society. They seem to be squeezing us from both ends.
They really do. I mean, you know, the other example of this is that Kelo decision, where the Supreme Court held that state and local institutions can take somebody's home away from them in order to give it to a developer. It's unbelievable.
Really?
This is America, and they're letting them do that.
Of course, there are those who will say that, that's been the state of practice for a long time, and certainly it has, as your local redevelopment agency has been doing exactly that for a long time. But finally, that case got to the Supreme Court, and it was supposed to clean it up. And instead of cleaning it up, it just threw a little gasoline on the fire that is burning freedom in America. And that's... That's sad for you and I, for every baby boomer in America, but it's particularly sad for our children and our posterity beyond that, because if we're not able to salvage these principles here and now, they're going to be lost to all of humanity for a very long time. We'll be back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show in just a few moments. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show with our final minutes here with our special guest, Jacob Hornberger, of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Jacob, tell us about the Future of Freedom Foundation and how it came into being, and just in a little more detail what it is you folks are doing.
Well, our mission is to provide people with an uncompromising moral, philosophical, and economic case for the free society. And we address all types of issues. What we do, our special niche, is to take current events and analyze them in terms of these uncompromising moral, philosophical, and economic issues. We have a publication called Freedom Daily. We have a daily, that's by subscription, and we've got a daily email update that we consider the best free market editorial page on the internet. Goes out every morning to people. It's better than reading the editorial page on your local newspaper. That's free for the asking. And I founded the organization 15 years ago. As you said earlier, I'd been a trial attorney, and I just felt like this country's moving in a very, very bad direction. And I decided, you know, I think I'm going to get involved and try to move things in a better, freer, more peaceful, prosperous direction. And that's what we do. We battle with the power of ideas, trying to get people to think about these things, to reflect upon them. Not everyone agrees with us on everything. We don't even agree with each other on everything. But our job is, people will always sense that, hey, this is an organization that's trying to get this country in a better direction.
Well, you know, and the thing that appeals to me is expressed in your latest Freedom Daily by you with this statement. You talk about how advocates of liberty seem to have, many of them have resigned themselves to devoting their lives to reforming and improving federal programs and policies rather than fighting for their eradication. And that's so true. You know, it's a premise of the Fabian ideology that they seek compromise and are willing to give delay in exchange for compromise. You know, and once we compromise the principle, we've lost the war. It's just a matter of time before they pour the dirt over the top of us. And the idea that we want to fight this rather than work with it is such an important concept, because it's the only way we're going to salvage liberty in this country.
That's right, and moral principles cannot be compromised. I mean, you know, it is black and white. Right and wrong is right and wrong, and you know, sometimes in your personal life there's some gray areas, but you know that it's wrong to take what doesn't belong to you, and that's.
Well, excuse us for that, but our audience has returned from some commercial breaks, and we're just talking with our guest, Jacob Hornberger, about the principles that are worth fighting for, and that principles aren't to be compromised. I always like to say it's worth compromising the price of a loaf of bread, but it's not worth compromising the principles of liberty.
That is excellent. I might steal that idea from you. I haven't heard that one. That's very, very good. Well, I'd like to invite your listeners, Mike, to visit our website. It's fff.org, and subscribe to our email update. And if you like what we do, maybe over time support us. We depend on voluntary donations. And I think we can move this country in a better direction through the power of ideas, one person at a time.
Well, and that's what it takes. It is one person at a time. It's a realization that each of us have to come to. That really pertains to our future, and you know, we can either allow this transformation of America, the land of the free, into a land of the controlled, or we can work hard, struggle, make the transition, get ourselves back on track, and leave our children something that's really worth leaving. You know, the sustainable development mantra always talks about preserving things for future generations, like the salamanders that roam the California coastline. But you know, those of us who are working to these quote preservation ends of the environmental movement need to take a second thought and think what it is if our children are subjugated to the rules of salamander first and human beings, private property and free individual action second. That's not going to bode well for anybody. That's not going to bode well for our monetary system, for our standards of living, and mostly for the spirit of humanity if we allow this process of environmental nonsense to continue. And, you know, and that's one area. I think tomorrow, Congress is scheduled to vote on the reauthorization of the Endangered Species Act. And one of the great disappointments I have, this year is the fact that so-called property rights, advocates are signing up for the compromise of this reauthorization of an Endangered Species Act that really cements the idea that species are of equal value and that human beings need to take their spot in the back of the line and that private property needs to be surrendered to the concerns of frogs and salamanders and the like. And that's where the ideas that you know are regularly expressed at the Future of Freedom Foundation can be so useful. And I want to thank you for all the good hard work that you've been doing for a very long time in expressing these ideas and spreading them out amongst the American public.
Yeah, thank you for those nice words. And I echo what you say about the EPA. I mean, it's a very, very tyrannical organization. But what's important is that there's a lot of good work being put out by the free market group showing how the free market can preserve the environment much better than the government does.
Well, that shouldn't be a surprise to anybody except for those people who are in line for the sustainability grants, which are flowing across the country in huge numbers, strapping the rest of us with higher tax burdens while these guys take their money to pretend they're actually doing something for the environment when, in fact, all they're doing is destroying the future of themselves and their children. Well, again, I want to thank you and hope to have you back. And I would recommend to our listeners that they check out fff.org.
Yeah, or just Google the Future of Freedom Foundation.
Okay.
And again, we got a free FFF email update. All they got to do is sign up. I think they'll like our stuff.
Well, I'll vouch for that. And thanks again, and good evening. And I'll look forward to communicating again in the future.
Likewise. Thank you, Mike, and thank your listeners.
Well, thank you. And we're going to look forward to our next hour here on the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. Our guest will be Will Rogers, and we're going to have an esoteric subject that we're going to bring right down to the level of visioning councils and what we can do about it. And that that interview will be with Will Roberts, who has been our guest before. And if you have not gotten your copy of the Sustainable Development Guide from Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, check our website, because if you want to deal with sustainable development, that's the way to do it.
The views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, welcome to the second hour of the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show here on September 28, 2005. And in the second hour, our guest is going to be William Roberts. And the discussion is going to be on an inquiry into the meaning, purpose, and history of logical positivism. Now, we're going to have to define what logical positivism is and why it's relevant to you and where society is today, but that'll come in a moment. You know, our continuing series on the effect of Auguste Comte's philosophy of positivism is going to expand tonight as researcher William Roberts looks at how 20th century social scientists began transforming the purpose of language in order to engineer a new world order of compliant and controlled global citizens. We're going to learn how paid facilitators, the Sustainable Development Vision Plans, use language games to subdue thought in public action. Now, the training for that all comes through an understanding of logical positivism. Will, are you with us?
I certainly am, Michael, and I'm glad to be back.
Well, it's good to hear you. For guests who might be tuning in for the first time, Will has been a guest, back in May, describing the 19th century philosopher Auguste Comte's, French philosopher Auguste Comte's philosophy of positivism, which sounds good at first blush, but you then came back for 2 hours in the month of June in our War on Reason series and discussed, and really the concluding segment of the War on Reason series, and discussed how positivism, legal positivism, an outgrowth of the philosophy of positivism, has been used to engage in an all-out war on natural law. And that really accounts for the mess that America is in today. And today we're going to take it a step further and look at logical positivism, which is the idea of how word games can be played and the meaning of words can be compromised so that the users and players of these games can manipulate society into this new world order of legal positivism and government control over all of humanity.
Well, that's a really good opening, Michael, and you do cover most of the points. And as when we look at legal positivism or positivism as a base system of philosophy, it has many branches. And even Auguste Comte, when he was working it out, was looking at all of the various sciences as being branches out of the same trunk. And so when we look at positivism and its outgrowths, its outshoots, we realize, of course, that when he was writing his treatises, he was a very young man, and at the time, you know, people still rode horses. You know, we're talking a while ago. And today, of course, we've had 200 years of advance of these techniques, and some of it has gone by the wayside, but the very kernels and the very cores can be found. And in my research, once you get hooked into this positivist idea and start tracking all of the people that it involved and that it influenced, why, it becomes just an absolute octopus. And tonight, foregoing some of the historical, which we've covered in previous broadcasts, we'll just take a look right at logical positivism and some of the things that I've found in my research that the listeners can go on from there and expand and use. But the core of our broadcast here this evening hopefully will be to alert people that something has changed in the hen house, and that words are not being used as they were in the past, and that as we become more outward in our community work, we need to be aware of what's happening when we come up against some of these paid facilitators, because they've got tools in their toolbox that we're not aware of, and hopefully this evening we'll get it. So logical positivism, then, is a more recent branch of the positive philosophy. But as with all isms, and anyone that's done research has seen this, but as with all isms for the new researcher, there's always a founder, and there's almost always a faith statement. So an ism is like a belief system, and logical positivism is not different at all. And during the period from 1923 to 1936, now that's right in between the wars, this group formed, and it was called the Vienna Circle, and obviously that's Vienna, Austria. Now that's just after the collapse then of the Habsburg Empire, which basically dominated Central Europe for a long time. And so,
and this is roughly 100 years after Auguste Comte laid out the philosophy of positivism and his positivism positivist religion.
For all intents and purposes, the two time periods are 100 years apart, and they're almost identical, because when Auguste Comte was writing, his was right at the end of the French Revolution, and here we're now turning all of Europe over upside down one more time, and the Habsburgs has collapsed. And we're redrawing the maps of Europe just as Napoleon redrew the maps of Europe. So the time periods are very similar. And what we're looking at is this, really, it's kind of a chaotic state of mind that was happening there. And, of course, in 1923, what a change indeed. I mean, you had people on one hand that were looking into atomic research. Albert Einstein was writing the theory of relativity. On the other hand, you had the Daisy Churn Company that was getting into Daisy products. You had people that were kind of trying to come up with an idea for an automobile, somebody else coming up with a steam locomotive. The clerk at the patent office in America said, well, we all closed the patent office. We've invented everything that can be. It was absolute chaos. And there was a chaotic morass of scientific and philosophic thought that existed at the time. And I think genuinely, the original Vienna Circle positivists were setting out on a mission where they actually believed that they were going to be doing something very, very good and very timely, and it may very well have been that way, but it just is one of those things where there's two sides to every issue. There's a proper use of a tool and an improper use of a tool, and whoever calls the tune and pays the price can get the work that they want out of whatever tool that you're looking at. So out of this new branch of philosophy then, the basic primacy here is observation in assessing the truth of statements of fact. And as we learned in Auguste Comte's system of positive philosophy, Auguste Comte set aside, he said, everything is relative. This is the only absolute. He set aside all of the metaphysical arguments. He set aside all of the ethical arguments, because they couldn't be proven in empirical science. They weren't facts that you could put your eyes on. You couldn't hear it. You couldn't smell it, you couldn't taste it, you couldn't touch it, and so they were just meaningless. And so he rejected all of that. He rejected the first causes and the final outcomes, and he concentrated just on those things that you could put your hands around. So a number of these members of the original Vienna Circle were actually scientists. Now, as I've mentioned to you in the past, I've never been able to find anything scientific that they've done, but they have written considerable number of books. And so we see that there's more to science, and particularly the social sciences, than meets the eye. There's the tangible things that we've done with the Industrial Revolution, but during the same amount of time that we've gone from a horse and buggy, you know, to a new automobile, like the new car for this year, with all the bells and whistles attached, also have the mental sciences, the social sciences, have been making this advance. And some of the tools that they're using now, the supercomputers, DOS, COBOL, all of the various and sundry programs that are available for manipulating the use of language, their tools now have gotten to be so powerful that marketing specialists go into the social science laboratories at the universities and they say, hey guys, look into this for us, and they do. So the Vienna Circle positivists were scientists. They wanted to redefine the aim and function of science. Now, that's a troubling statement in that, what do you mean, redefine the aim and function? I thought that science and technology was supposed to make products that we could use and find cures for diseases and whatnot. But there's this little serpent that lies there. What do we mean when we say redefine the function of aim and function of science?
Well, if I was to jump ahead, I look from the experiences I've had and so many others have had, we now have what's called ecology science. I'm still trying to figure out how that's scientific at all. It's just a set of rules, I mean, where everything is measured and nothing is ever understood and nothing is gained. But there's a lot of measurement and they call that science. So it's almost as though science has become, for the social scientists, a system of measurement. Is that related to the logical positivist theory?
Absolutely, because the logical positivist, again, grounds everything in mathematics. Everything is measurement. Everything is data. Everything is statistics. But it's also a words business, and that's really where the focus is. With ecology and some of the other sciences, we got to remember that there are niche builders, and when the niche builders can get a leg up, they build a niche and they wall up a little fortress for themselves, and they create their own stronghold. And a lot of the sciences that I've seen in my years in the development business, a lot of these niches that are occupied by ecologists and stream biologists and things like that, yes, they're branches of science, but as whether or not they're really contributing anything or not is up to the eyes of the beholder. This concept of meaningful language, then, is the language of mathematics. And all other language, the positivists felt, lacked cognitive meaning. In other words, it was just not knowable. And so only the propositions of mathematics and empirical science have any sense to them. But where we're really going to focus tonight, we could go on and on endlessly, not necessarily endlessly, but certainly for far more than an hour, on the intricacies of other aspects of the science. But the logical positivist Rudolf Carnap is a very important person in the logical positivist school of reasoning, and his name is spelled C-A-R-N-A-P, Rudolf Carnap. He uses the word verification definitionally by stating, quote, a proposition is verifiable if its truth value can be determined by reference to sense experience, close quote. Now, a lot of words, but it's very, very important, because that word verifiable and tied to the sense experience becomes definitional of what logical positivism is. Let me use an easy example. All dogs are animals, a proposition might say. All dogs are animals. All cats are animals. Therefore, all cats are dogs. Now, anyone hearing it would know that that's not true. It's a fallacious statement. And in logic, that's exactly what Carnap was talking about. A proposition is verifiable if its truth value can be determined by reference to the sense experiences. All we have to do is look and see it's the dog that's barking and it's the cat that's meowing. So it just solves itself right there. But the Vienna Circle philosophers gave expression to this conviction in their criterion of empirical meaning. It's the verifiability criterion of empirical meaning, which is the likely source for Black's Law Dictionary's definition of logical positivism. And for the people that believe that all the social sciences are fuzzy, let's just remember that although you won't find logical positivism in your 95-cent Webster's school and office dictionary, you will find logical positivism, legal positivism, logical positivist jurisprudence, and positivism in general in the Black's Law Dictionary. And if the law merchants don't consider positivism to be squishy or of no importance, then I think maybe we should take note.
Well, it certainly has. It has had massive effects on the training of lawyers and the application of law.
Absolutely. And Charles Sanders Peirce is another one of the line of positivists, and he said that a belief is a habit of action, and that different beliefs give rise to different modes of action. And we can look at all at the various religions, whether you're Hindu, Buddhist, Judaism, Christianity, and each of those various belief systems have a habit of action that goes with them, and it gives rise to different modes of action. And what he's trying to get to there is that our idea of anything is our idea of its sensible effects. So our reality is shaped so much by our words. And when the Vienna Circle logical positivists, grounding their philosophical claims in experience only, and manipulating statements according to an impartial system of logic, mathematical logic, they allegorically put language under a scientific microscope. They made language the study of a science. And when they did that, a chasm, a deep void, began to open up between the reality experience that is grounded in casual social interpersonal communication, in other words, the way you and I would talk around the barbecue pit, and the reality experienced by the super social scientists and the ruling elite that calls the tune. So there's two paths that are opening up here, and we need to know about these two paths because we make a lot of language errors when we fail to recognize it. That words, whether we consider them traditionally, as you and I might do in the living room or whatever, words, when we consider them traditionally, or as quote-unquote signs or symbols in a arcane mathematical symbology around the manipulation of words, when we consider words as signs by the logician, that we must remember that words do have meanings. Just like that is a cat, that is a dog. Their meanings are significant, and the significance of the words goes far to shape a society whose language is comprised of those words. So,
are you suggesting that the Vienna Circle, you talk about a chasm, explain how that chasm creates a change in communication modes that people use?
Okay. Basically, Ludwig Wittgenstein, another one of the principal Vienna positivists, he advanced that language is best conceived here now, and this is a key word, as an entity involving the use of words as tools. Now, that's just a little bit different than the way I relate when I'm talking to my neighbor. I'm not thinking about every single word, but the logical positivist is looking at the use of language as an entity involving the use of words as tools.
And so in other words, when somebody says sustainable development, the notion is that it is a tool to communicate some precision, even though the words to the average person have no precision at all?
Well, we'll get to it, but in the time, in the context used, it would be considered as a tool. And so let's focus on that for a second. It's a tool. You think it has meaning, but let's just hold on to it and say that it is a language tool. It's a term. The word sustainable is a tool. And when we are using these tools, we need to understand that to these people, not to defame them, I'm sure they had good intention in the beginning, but to them, words are not labels of things. They enable one to engage in a language game. And that language game then has a certain framework or a system how it's used, where the meaning of a word is its use in the language. Well, what do you mean? I thought we could go to the dictionary. Well, it depends on how the word is used. And the use of the word is like understanding the very rules of the game. And where we, the people, make the mistake when we go to one of these Soviet Council watershed groups, private partner dialectic sessions, where we make the mistake is that we confuse the use of words and not understand that we're being manipulated as if we were in a game. So when the confusion that comes in when we make up new rules as we go along, or we misapply the rules just as a game, or we conceive of the game in some, this is important, conceive of the game in a static fashion. In other words, instead of thinking of it as a social dynamic, we're thinking of language as a static, where it's just, this is the way it is, and dog means dog, and cat means cat. So that's where we start to go into confusion. Confusion and perplexity arise when a user of language creates new rules, violates the old ones, or misconceives language. And this is where the problems arise then, when language goes on holiday, that is, when the user takes off in a new or an unpredictable direction as a result of failing to abide by the rules of a particular language game. And so when you and I are talking and preparing to go to a meeting or something, we're using casual social intercommunication techniques that we've learned since childhood. Perhaps we've polished it up and we've gone to the dictionary and we've expanded our vocabulary. But then when we arrive at this meeting, we're going into a language game, and if we don't understand the rules of that game, our chances of succeeding in there is going to be slim. It's just like the dentist has a language, the orthopedic surgeon has a language, the lawyer has a language, the surveyor has a language, and the urban planner has a language, and you just go through the litany. All of the different niches that have been carved out have a language that goes with it, and that's how they keep strangers out. It goes all the way back to the feudal system. So what Wittgenstein then did, he proposed to resolve problems not by answering them, doesn't that sound familiar, but by showing that they involve confusions concerning the use of language. And to understand a word then is much, this is key now, to understanding an act, which makes no sense until one notices what the act does and consequently realizes what the act is for, what the purpose of it is, and what meaning it has. So I'll repeat it. Understanding an act, it's like a play. It doesn't make any sense until one notices what the act does and consequently realizes what the act is for, what the purpose of it is, and what meaning it has.
So let me see if I understand.
Go ahead.
You're suggesting that 80 years ago, some social scientists gathered together, evaluated the nature of language, and concluded that language could be used as a tool, a game, if you will, by using meanings that perhaps others would be unaware of in order to obtain results that others would not be suspect of until it was too late?
That's one application. Because by perceiving it as a game, the very fact that speaking of language, it becomes a part of an activity or a form of life. And it's like being in a game where the golfer puts his tee in the ground. It would be senseless to ask what the move stands for or represents. Why, it doesn't stand for anything. He's just putting a tee in the... But what does it represent? Why, it doesn't mean anything. He just put a tee in the grass. Look, he put a ball on it. Yeah, but it doesn't mean anything. It's just part of the game. So it's senseless then, logically, you know, speaking logical posit from a logical syntactician standpoint, it becomes senseless to ask what the word as used stands for or represents. So when you and I are discussing sustainable development or Agenda 21 or any of the, you know, environmental, economic environment or the social environment or any of the various and sundry terminology, it's senseless for us to ask what these words mean, which is causes so much confusion because the average person coming in and buying a copy of Agenda 21, Earth Summit Agenda 21, the United Nations Program of Action from Rio for $25 from the United Nations publications, buying it and bringing it home and reading it, unless you understand that this is not necessarily intended to answer questions, for one. Number two, it's not necessarily going to define terms. Number two. Number three, it is completely a perfect defense for whoever uses it. So when the facilitator's up at the podium and he's got milk and honey just pouring out of his mouth and his, you know, $500 Brooks Brothers suit is perfect, his bronze face, his white teeth, all he needs to do is to perform the act of facilitating a sustainable development meeting and run it for 2 hours to fulfill the NEPA requirements for a public meeting, leave without being lynched, and he's done his job. To him, it's a job, man. It's an act. And so it's senseless then to grill them on what they mean by sustainable development. Because to that person, for in the context that he's working, that's not something that he's privy to. It might not even be privy to the general group of environmentalists that are going, coming and going to these meetings. But to some people, at each stage, it has a different meaning. And so, therefore, it is senseless to ask what the word means unless we go into the context, deal with the speaker, with the group for which the word has the specific meaning, and quite frankly, the meaning for the general public is far different from what would be in Mikhail Gorbachev's mind when he thinks sustainable development.
So what does that mean for the general public? What does that mean for the for society generally? And how is that infected or afflicted the American society?
Well, the first place is to understand that because of the throwout, if you will, of ethics and metaphysical language, and because the logical positivist grounds everything on this criterion of verifiability, what it means is that when we have done our homework and we've marshaled our energies and we've got a group of people and we're going off to one of these meetings and we're going to try and defend our liberty, we'll try and defend our neighborhood, our community, against an intrusion from an outside source who's going from global to local to enact another segment of the Agenda 21 agenda, it's at that point that we have to get a bridle on our tongues and make sure that the information that we say during the very few minutes that we'll be allowed to speak at all doesn't open up the door for attack from a trained facilitator, because the facilitator can completely overlook all of, or set aside all of this data that you brought, the photos, the circles and arrows on the back like Alice's restaurant, and set it all aside by simply keying in on some particular phraseology that you might have used or let slip out of your mouth that is not absolutely verifiable empirically. Okay, the criterion of verifiability. Because they can marginalize you on that point, and then at that, the rest of your testimony just goes out the window. So what we're talking about, again, here is this, we have a two-fold process happening. The first part is that we have language about objects. That's what you and I use. The coin is silver. That's the way we speak. Everybody understands it. To the logical positivist or the logical syntactician, they speak in terms of a meta-language, and meta, M-E-T-A, hyphen, language. It's a language about language. So the first one is the coin is silver. That's the object language. We're talking about a coin that happens to be, in this case, is silver. But in a meta language, we're talking a language that talks about the language. And here's a quote. The proposition, the coin is silver, has four words in it. So we're talking or dialoguing about now our previous phrase. We're talking about the object language. And when we talk about an object language, then we're working in the meta language. And these are very simple examples. But if we were to go ahead then and build a science around that, then there's an opportunity for misunderstanding, and I'm afraid that's where we oftentimes find ourselves.
You made a comment earlier in this context about ethics and metaphysics not being a part of the language construction of a logical positivist. Expand on that a little bit, because that strikes me as profound and would lead to all kinds of issues. Although we're going to have to come back to that when we take a break here, but if we can get a little introduction to that before we take that break, proceed. We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station. I lost my timing there a little bit. And, Will, what I'd like to understand more fully is how ethics plays in the construct of language under this concept of logical positivism.
Okay. I'll try and hit that as quickly as I can. It's an enormous aspect of positivism. And to understand it fully, one really needs to get into the books and read the thinking behind it. But in the most kernel-like or quickest format, the idea of an absolute, like a first cause, Aristotle would talk about the first causes, or the end cause, or the last cause. There's a great Latin phrase, it's called, it goes ignoramus, et ignorabimus. It's we do not know, and we will not know. The things that we can't empirically, or that we just can't put our hands on, it's not sense-oriented. They're meaningless to try and work out from a philosophical standpoint, unless you just want to go round and round and round, because really, it just, as far as Auguste Comte was concerned, it's a circular argument, it's circular reasoning, it's endless theological around and around about the absolutes. And he rejected that as being meaningless talk. It didn't resolve anything. Nobody knows how it started. Nobody knows when the last day is going to be, so we don't go there. Now, from an ethical standpoint, if you look at, I think Wittgenstein broke this out pretty well, but if you look at commands, thou shalt not kill, he felt that's an ethical viewpoint, and that he thought it was a disguised command, do not kill. And because it was a disguised command, and commands are neither true nor false, then that was set aside. Do we understand?
So basically, the concept is to disregard the principles that existed through history regarding ethics and right and wrong, unless they can be verifiably shown in a mathematical equation. Is that where we're headed?
Well, that's basically where we're headed, and that's not just where we're headed, it's where we are. And you can hear it from the church community. You know, the people are very concerned. They're trying to find their roots again, but their roots have been sawn off at the knees, and it's happened quite a while ago. I remember as a child, I don't recall the exact year, but there was a banner headline, I think it was in the New York Times, or perhaps it was in the Time magazine, and spread all across the paper. It said, God is dead.
It was Time magazine. I remember that as a teenager. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show with our guest, William Roberts, and we're discussing logical positivism and how it, in effect, negates the historical notions of ethics and right and wrong, the notion that that if it's not verifiable in a mathematical or scientific notion, that it is to be disregarded. You know, Will, I see examples of that floating all around society. I mean, you can look at SAT tests, you know, the college entrance tests, and, you know, they focus on the necessity for a changed future, and the question is why we should disregard the past and the teachings and the philosophy of the past as we look to a new and improved world. And that sort of reflects this concept of logical positivism, does it not?
It does, and Michael, and some of this is what drove me into it in the first place. You know, I had what I consider to be a revelation, this idea of that there's an all-out war raging between legal positivism and the natural law, and is in the rise of statism and so on, and it continues. But that got me studying, and it got me interested because I was trying to figure out whether I was just having some kind of a weird thought or whether there was actually something to it. But Auguste Comte's system really is a heavy hitter, even though it's more of a framework than an absolute detailed roadmap. It provides this framework. And in this framework, you'll find the groundwork for all of what, not all, but a good portion of what Karl Marx was writing, and a good portion of what you get out of the Fabian Socialists. You'll get a lot from, you know, George Bernard Shaw, George Orwell, Aldous Huxley. And what he was basically, what Comte said, this law of three stages, was that we begin in a theological stage, we transition from a theological stage to the metaphysical stage, and that today we're transitioning, we have a shot, we have an opportunity, in his opinion, to go into the positive stage, where we set aside all of those theological and metaphysical ideas of our past as being meaningless. And you can find absolute markings of this by simply going to your children's school library and look in the high school library or someplace and try and find books on philosophy. I dare you.
Well, you can certainly get, what's those wizard TV shows, Harry Potter?
Harry Potter and every different kind of an incantation and a magic spell. You can get all kinds of stuff on witchcraft and spell casting and voodoo and comparative information. But you won't find the great voices of the Reformation. You won't be able to find any of the writings of Martin Luther or Melanchthon or Ruplin or Calvin or Swingley or any of them. So this process has been coming for some time, and we are transitioning, unless there's something that prevents it. We are transitioning away from those old roots. They're throwing out the Ten Commandments. Next, there's going to be something else, and we're going into this positive stage. And as we transition into this positive stage, and it's been a long time coming, 500 years from October 31st, 1517, but as we go into this stage, this positivist stage, we'll have a new certainty because we'll be basing everything on science. And let's just hope it's not junk science, but it seems to sometimes be that way.
Well, I think looking at a lot of the social sciences, you look at the college curriculum today, and it's filled with notions of social science that just don't make sense, certainly reflect a new world view, and you go to college and you're not going to get some of the historic philosophers and ideas in history itself that reflect the truths that have been known by human beings for millenniums. It is a throwout of all of that as we begin to train children up in a workforce through workforce investment acts and No Child Left Behind, and put the kids out into swamps during the school days so that they can learn how to be swamp masters as opposed to being thinking and functioning human beings acting in their own regard and in accordance with principles and concepts and ethics that have been developed through all of history. So there is a sea change, and what I'm gleaning in understanding from you is that language plays a huge role in creating the opportunity for making that sea change, and as in our last hour in discussing with Jacob Hornberger, it really is creating worker bees and slave masters or the you know the beekeepers that our system is seems to be gravitating toward, and of course that takes a different language than the language that most of us were accustomed to 3 or 4 decades ago.
Exactly. And the logical positivist is not when he's manipulating this language, he's not doing physics, chemistry, or biology. He's manipulating signs or symbols. He's manipulating signs and symbols which might, keyword, might be assigned meanings later on so that they become words or sentences in a science or a theory, whether it be chemistry, biology, physics, sociology, economics, political science, law, you name it. And so he sharply has separated this work of the philosopher logician from the work of the scientist. But when a social scientist is working with a social group or a culture or a folk, I guess I've seen that word, folk and folk ways, in the sociology texts that I've gotten in this research. When a social scientist is working at work, just the process of doing the work alters the society or the group that he's working on. And when we begin to change language, marketing is an excellent a place to use this. And you could go into in great detail or a great number of the nuances in modern marketing as to how they have taken advantage of these tools. But you could just see a full page advertisement, and there will be a woman sitting on the floor in front of a white couch, and she's sitting on a nice white carpet, and there's a hardwood floor there, and maybe she's got a silk tank top on and sweatpants and big socks and all that. And up at the top, there's one word in big letters, and it says, "Imagine." And then down at the bottom, it's XYZ department store. Now, what is being said here? They're using the very well thought out, very well established combination between that word and that image to focus that whatever you imagine is in that department store. Now, I remember growing up looking at the Sears catalog, and boy, they didn't just give you a picture of the thing. They told you everything it would do, everything it wouldn't do. Clean your teeth, brush your hair, comb your, and all for only $9.99. But wait, that's not all. They threw in a case, a carrying case, and an instruction manual. You know, but as we've gone through this process, where the media has gotten involved, and where the social scientists and the computer scientists are merging databases and collecting data, August Comte had no clue. If he had been able to see where we were going to go in such really a short period of time, his idea of a super elite running the whole world, backed up by this cadre of super social scientists at their beck and call, ruling over all of the rest of the world as the proletariat, had he visioned the computer in this, and in some ways he did, because when he was talking about his positive logic, he very clearly established that there would be a universal algebra that would treat on the use of words, and I see that as like computer programming. And there are so many aspects to his philosophy that when you get an idea for what he's talking about and then you apply it with the new technologies, it's powerful and it's frightening, because it goes so far beyond just marketing products. It goes so far beyond. When we went from the point where we were concerned about not being able to make enough products to the point where the manufacture of products was no longer the issue, the whole dynamic of the marketplace changed. From that point forward, this has been it's an analysis to see what we can do with the manipulation. You know, if we put it in the newspaper that we're going to go 20 degrees below and that the price of fuel is going up because we just happen to have a whole container load of socks down at the hardware store and they're the wrong size, nobody wants them, and then we put them out in the front of the store, people come into the store, they've heard it on the news, they saw it on TV, or it's going to be cold, a cold snap coming, cost of fuel's going up, and you go in, you see this great big box of socks, and it says, stock up before the cold snap,
and people just buy up the whole box of socks. But when it was just one manufacturer trying to do his thing, that dynamic was never available, but it certainly is today.
Well, that kind of goes to the, it does directly go to the issue that Terry Hayfield talked about, again, in the War on Reason, about how the fiat money system, the capitalist, socialist, classless society dynamic that he calls the permanent revolution, had a problem with excess production and underconsumption that really results from a fiat or funny money system, and that this is the problem that creates real issues for the monetary system, and really which is what drives the whole sustainable development movement. That is, how do we recover and maintain control from a system that has a limited shelf life? And so you're tying that in the context of how the marketing regime grows out of a necessity to continue to clear that excess capacity, the inherent problem of a fiat money capitalist system.
And it's all driven by words, because our words shape our realities. And if you remember, we're saying there was a chasm that opened up, and that chasm was between casual social interpersonal, you know, communication skills, the way we talk, versus the scientific analysis of the use of language and the concept of using language as games rather than as a way of communicating. So it gives them a tremendous amount of, it gives the opportunity, I don't like to use theys and thems, we can put names here, but it opens the door and creates the opportunity to go far beyond traditional uses of words. And so when we find ourselves in these meetings where we're dealing with a facilitated meeting, and we understand that the facilitator has gathered people together, intends to dialogue everyone into consensus, and are using these words out of the sustainable development dialogue, where we can have more power, first of all, is to recognize that this is a language game, and that this person is an actor in the process. And so we need to be able to assert that we need to have this person stop and define that term. You said sustainable. When you think sustainable, what do you mean? When you mean sustainable, what are you thinking? Define that term so that we, the people, can understand what it is you're saying. Because what you're saying is just a game. It's logical positivism. I understand the program. I think. I recognize what you're doing. I don't like that. Would you please say it in language that I can understand? And at that point, I hope that we will be able to start turning these dialogue meetings from a driven consensus orientation back into the real world, come out of the language of the super social scientist and the elite, and come back into an interpersonal communication so that we can talk about it. I don't like this idea. I've sat at my house, I've done my research, I've gone through this stuff, I've come down to the meeting, I'm on my own time, I'm not making $300,000 a year. I resent the fact that you will not define your term.
So when they start talking about equity, environment, and the economy, their favorite 3E terms, you know, if you tell them to put those words to definition, they're going to struggle, because in the back room they have a certain meaning, and of course the gamesmanship of the backroom meanings of those words, which are not dictionary meanings, is something they can't talk about when they're out in public. And so the logical positivist playing facilitator in these consensus scams is going to be hard pressed to define quality of life or the environment or all the other buzz terms that are used in this whole transformation of America or restructure of our government along the sustainable development model.
Exactly. And what we're doing is we're going to, instead of accepting that it's senseless to ask what the word means, we're going to realize that we're involved in a game, and that the words only have certain meanings to that dialoguer, to that consensus machine up there, the facilitator,
the words only have a certain meaning, and he's trained to do this. He's trained in the meta language that relates to Agenda 21 well enough to be able to handle the average farmer. And when you start to grill them on it, instead of allowing them to marginalize us on a they, them, us, we fang type mental structure, instead of allowing the facilitator to manipulate the people through the language game, and we need to understand that these words really mean nothing. Now, somebody will come along and they'll show me what they mean and I'll recant, but until then, this is a perfect defense. That's a legal term, perfect defense. You can't sue sustainable development, and you can't sue him for talking about it, because it doesn't mean anything. It shifts. It's perfect in context every time it's used, because it's being used by the speaker to the group in a dialogue for consensus. It's completely a perfect defense legally. And so they know, as long as they stay in that ground, they are free from accountability. And we deserve better than that from the people that we're paying or hired or having to listen to or deal with, that stand between where we are today and where we need to be 50 years from now to restore our constitutional republican representative system of government. And we need to stand firm on that, but we must realize that the next time we just tell them to stop playing the word game.
Well, some of those words, affordable housing, or best management practices, or preserve, or benefit of all, traffic calming, stakeholder. Boy, they have a hard time coming up with a definition of the word stakeholder that everyone wouldn't find offense to. And they don't come up with definitions. They just use these words and assume that because they, on surface, sound right, that they get accepted. So it precisely is what you're saying. It is a word game, and in the back room there is a meta language, that is a language that interprets the meaning of the words, but that meta language is not put out front, because they have meanings when they mean affordable housing. What they mean is centralized control over where you live and how you live and what you do where you live there. They can't come out and tell you that. They've got to say, well, we're going to make it affordable for everyone. It's going to cost us twice as much to build. You know, if you press them on that issue, we, the government, are in control of who lives there and the terms upon which people who live there will live, and we pay big subsidies to those partners of ours who will build these affordable housing units, but they're not going to talk about those things unless they're pressed to define their language, expose their meta language that sits in the back room, and begin to be forced to stop playing this logical positivism game of playing with the meaning of words.
Very good. And when I first got this Agenda 21 Rio Summit, which I haven't had for very long, less than a month, I just treated it like any of the other books and looked through it. The first thing I noticed, there's no index in the back. The second thing I noticed is it was filled with technical terms. There's no glossary of terms. They do have a listing of their acronyms. And then, as far as authorship, it just simply says that it was created by the nations. So it's so completely, perfectly defendable as it is that you can't break it with a stick. And it was designed that way. That's not an accident. It's part of the language game. And this would be, I hope, useful to the listener that will take the time, perhaps, and look into logical positivism a little bit further. Try and go back and understand more and get a better handle on Auguste Comte's positivism and the writings of his predecessor and mentor, Henry St. Simon, because what I believe, and I may be mistaken, I would look forward to someone coming up and proving me wrong, but what I believe is that the system of positivism is the system that lies behind communism, socialism, capitalism, and most of the isms that have come down the pike. The Illuminati like to change the name of their system just about as often as they change socks.
Well, so do the people running the Corralitos Valley plan here in Santa Cruz County. Every time the citizens object to the meaningless words that are put in the plan, they suddenly come out with a new plan with new meaningless words that then get subjected to attack. I think they're on their fourth draft now. So it demonstrates the backroom activity and the meaninglessness of the words, but behind all of the meaninglessness is a plan.
That's correct.
Social scientists have been working on and perfecting. You know, the Vienna Circle was 80 years ago. They've been developing this concept for a long time and perfecting it, and now it's time to launch it on the American people. And the question is, are the American people dumbed down enough yet by their educational system that plays these same games, or do we have the spunk that our ancestors bequeathed us to recognize when soup is coming from a stone and calling it for what it is? That is a fraud.
That's right, Michael. And in the few weeks coming, I hope, you'll be going into how this is rolled into the legal aspect of things. But when we have a legislation that comes out that is a Help America Vote Act, that kind of bill title and that kind of legislation I find offensive simply because I understand logical positivism. And to be talked down at that degree, as if the American people need to be helped to vote, as if we couldn't vote much better if we had an open and fair election with a pencil in our hand, a piece of paper, and someone that's honest to count them, that kind of legislation just lets me know that logical positivism is alive and well, and it's operating all around us. And so we must remember, if nothing else, that we must begin to think today of words as tools that can be used in various ways and can be understood as bringing about certain changes in behavior or in the ways of looking at things. Because that system is the way that the average person can be made completely a fool in public because they don't understand what they're hearing. They're not confident now. They've seen it so many times on TV that they believe that a man isn't smart enough to speak. He nudges his wife. His wife doesn't have a clue. They don't say anything. The meeting comes. The meeting goes. The law is satisfied. Public notice has been given. And the project goes on impeded. And that's not the way our founders brought this country into place. Daniel Boone was brought under censure for giving away a little bit of money to one of the veterans' wives, I think it was. And he went back after he was upbraided by a farmer, and he went back on the floor of the House and voted against bills in the future that took money out of Peter's pocket to pay Paul.
That was Davy Crockett.
Was it Davy Crockett?
Yeah.
A great little story out of a history book. I can't recall which one it was, but that's the kind of a spirit that we can build again in this country. That's the kind of spirit that we have in our hearts. And if we have more tools, like the tools that you bring out every week, we'll be able to do more and more and more good for our nation by exposing some of the fraud that's going on at the upper levels.
Well, people need to understand, too, that the term logical positivism was coined by the guys who developed the system of manipulating words in order to manipulate the meaning of words in order to manipulate people. And so we just have to realize that the social scientists have the manipulation of words down to a science. And a piece of legislation that's one of my favorite is Bush's New Freedom Initiative, which calls for mental health conditioning for the American people starting at age 3. If that's not an example of how words are misused and how there's a secret meaning behind the contrivance of words and the gamesmanship that is being played with words, and the average American is just working hard to pay the taxes to support these social scientists while our liberties are one by one stacked away. And it all has to do about liberty and taking it away from us, because when people are controlled by the powercrats that seek the control of others, we end up in a deep hole. They get what they want, and we become mere chattel to a ruling elite. And that's happening faster and faster as the American middle class is peeled off layer by layer. And I'm somewhat curious about what happens when the sustainable mercenaries get peeled off themselves from their little grant funds, which are not going to last forever. And the awakening that those sorrowful people are going to experience at that point in time is going to be quite shattering.
It certainly will. It'll be an upstart for them. And anyone that is interested in obtaining any of the transcripts from this War on Reason series, any of the August Comte presentations that I've done, they're more than welcome to just drop me a note. The name, if you have your pencils handy, is William Roberts. And I'll give you a post office box It's P.O. Box 10, P.O. Box 10 in Rocky, like the ground, Rocky Comfort, Missouri, M.O., Rocky Comfort, Missouri, M.O. The zip code is 64861. And I'd look forward to getting your calls or your letters.
Or you can contact us at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, and we'll get that information for you. I suspect we'll put together a series on our August Comp discussions with Will Roberts. We appreciate all that you're doing, and we look forward to discussing the religion of August Comp in a coming episode of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. Thank you for listening tonight, and we'll be back next week with another edition of the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show.